Arthur Machen once wrote that strange things are lost and forgotten in obscure corners of a newspaper. This podcast will aim to prove that that statement is true.
Hello, and welcome to the third episode of Forgotten Darkness. I'm Andrew Gable. First and foremost, I guess I should say that no dogs were harmed in the making of this episode. Both our previous episodes have referred to either the poisoning of a dog in the first episode, or feeding dogs to a giant shark in the second episode, but there's none of that this time. In fact, dogs don't even figure in this story at all. In the late Victorian era, there was an unknown killer known as Jack the Ripper that stalked the East End of London. It's up for debate exactly how many women he killed. I've heard anywhere from 4 up to 18 or 19, depending on which researcher you read. Although in some regards, the murders were relatively tame by the standards of some of the depraved serial killers we've had since then, they inspired massive hysteria among the populace, probably mostly due to the inability of the police to catch the killer. But that was also probably fueled by unending, almost obsessive coverage in the London newspapers. The hysteria wasn't only confined to Britain, however, and in the years to follow, virtually every unsolved murder got referred to as the work of Jack the Ripper. Although, it's unlikely in the extreme that any of these actually were. Because, I mean, you had murders from Central America that were said to be Jack the Ripper. You had murders from Jamaica that were supposed to be Jack the Ripper. You had murders from California that were supposed to be Jack the Ripper. And, I mean, the guy didn't get around that much. Come on. But that's a matter for another day. There's actually entire podcasts out there that are devoted to all the minutiae of the Ripper case, if you're that interested. The years afterwards saw an unending parade of mysterious assailants, though, that were given similar monikers, probably because they saw how well it played in the media with Jack the Ripper. So, the years from 1890 into the 1900s had a literal plethora of Jacks. Because there was Jack the Hugger, there was Jack the Kisser, there was Jack the Clubber, there was Jack the Clipper, there was Jack the Slasher, Jack the Stabber, Jack the Terror, and there were even more unlikely names, like Jack the Inkslinger and Jack the Vitriol Thrower. Now, many of these Jacks would be considered probably some variety of sex offender or a more extreme fetishist in today's society. Quite a number of them were simple misogynists, and there were actually quite a few that were cross-dressers, because this was back in the days before that behavior was as tolerated as it is now. The idea of seeing a man walking around dressed as a woman was just really, really bizarre to people back then. And now it's like, okay, whatever. But the subject of this episode is a fellow called Jack the Shoe Slasher. Now, I'm not quite sure where he fell on that spectrum. I think probably it would probably be safe to say in the sex offender slash fetishist area. But anyway, this Jack terrorized Philadelphia and Baltimore in 1904 and 1905. In late December of 1904, I haven't been able to actually track down the initial report of the event. A young woman living near the police station in the northwestern Philadelphia suburb of Manayunk was assaulted by a mystery man who forced his way into her home. He punched her in the face several times, and then he ran away. Although the police had no real leads as to who this person was, they seemed to have had reason to think he resurfaced 2 weeks later, when on the morning of January 6th, a 22-year-old girl named Mary R. Quinn was found lying unconscious in a vacant lot at the intersection of Schurz Lane and Terrace Street, also in Manayunk. She had disembarked from a trolley car on Schurz Avenue late the previous evening, and she was walking past a vacant lot on Terrace Street when a man sprung from behind a picket fence, and he grabbed her, he punched and kicked her, and threw her to the ground. And then, that done, he ran away. And when Miss Quinn was found, she had lacerations on her head and scalp, and one of her ears was actually nearly bitten off. Now, probably luckily for her, and despite what you might be thinking hearing the details of that attack, there doesn't seem to have been any sexual assault. Though some connect these two assaults to the actions of Jack the Shoe Slasher, I kind of doubt that. At least in... I doubt the first one is, the one that actually came into the woman's house. I kind of doubt that's him. The one that attacked Mary Quinn, maybe. That could have been. There's some similarities. But at any rate, about a week later, on the night of January 15th, the Shoe Slasher properly appeared in the Moya Mensing area neighborhood of South Philadelphia. In 1905, this area, which was generally around 4th Street and Oregon Avenue, was the southern fringes of the city. A 21-year-old named Bertha Levy was out front of her home at 1621 South Beulah Street when she was attacked by a man who used a knife to slash at her legs and feet. He cut her skirt, and he nearly cut her shoe off. She ran into the house, and her cousin, who was visiting, her cousin's family, came out and chased the man, but he had gotten away. Not long after that, another young woman named Mamie Murphy was assaulted on Winston Street by a man who was presumably the same one. He slashed her skirt and this time managed to completely remove her shoe. But like before, the man escaped. In the next few hours, three other women in the area of Moya Mensing were attacked. Other people were usually present in the street when these women were accosted, but the man chose dark areas. He was really quick to in his quote-unquote work, and he always managed to escape. Officers Micklejohn and O'Connor were on the lookout for the man, who was generally described as about 5'7", with a mustache and a long black coat. So somebody had gotten a good look at him. Jack's activities in this section of Philadelphia had ceased, but a few days later he was heard from again. Early on the morning of January 18th, he attacked a 14-year-old girl named Ruth Zukoski near her home on North 11th Street between Silver and Somerset Streets. He initially attempted to accost her in an alleyway as she walked to a bakery near her home, but she ignored him and moved on. But then when she returned, the man was waiting right in front of her house, and he lashed out at her feet with a knife, and she ended up being the most severely injured of the Shoe Slasher's victims. She had lost a lot of blood, and when she was treated at a nearby hospital, it was also found that an artery and a tendon in the instep of her foot had both been severed, and it was thought that she was likely going to be crippled for the rest of her life. By that evening, he had reappeared again near the University of Pennsylvania. This time, he attacked an 18-year-old named Miriam Haynes, who was returning to her home on Walnut Street from visiting a friend. As she walked along South 34th Street, a man appeared from behind a tree and attacked her. He threw her to the ground, and as she picked herself up off the street, he ducked, slashed at her foot, and ran off. The entire assault had been witnessed by university students, and they brought Miriam to the hospital on campus. Jack the Slasher, the uncanny, dangerous will-o-wisp, who has been cutting the shoes of women and children in all parts of the city, coming apparently from nowhere and vanishing in the same mysterious manner, reappeared in the southern section of the city last night. The result was literally a reign of terror. Children were kept indoors all evening, no woman left her home without a male escort, extra policemen were placed in the districts where the slasher was reported to have appeared, and several men who were acting suspiciously were placed under arrest. Half a score of complaints regarding the actions of the fanatical Shoe Slasher were lodged with the police of the Moya Mensing Avenue station before midnight. Some of those who had seen the man told coherent stories of his conduct. They described him as being about 5'7" in height, with a dark beard and a long flowing overcoat. This is the same description that has been given of the man since his first appearance about a week ago. The beard is the only part of the description that has been added since then. The police said last night that they believed the whiskers were false. Philadelphia Inquirer, January 22, 1905. As is alluded to in that quote, the hysteria factor had begun to set in. On the evening of January 21st, what might have been an assault by the shoe slasher was avoided. This time back in his initial haunts in Moya Mensing. As she was walking with her niece along Wharton Street between 5th and 6th, a 23-year-old woman named Rebecca Klein managed to get away from a man who lunged at him. Now, that was one I find kind of debatable because he always attacked solitary women. And this is the first time he's attacked one when more than one person is present. But, as we'll see, it wouldn't have been the last time either. A short time later, there was a woman who went to the police and reported that there was a strange man loitering in Dickinson Park, holding a bouquet of flowers in which he had concealed a knife. He was offering the flowers to people, and the witness noticed that if they had taken them, he'd easily be able to slash at them with a knife quickly before getting away. And that's a strange and a very theatrical action, a very theatrical tactic. But the London Monster, who was a similar type offender who stabbed dozens of women in England back in the 1700s, had used that same tactic on numerous occasions, so it's not unheard of. And at any rate, the witness's story was backed up by a child who fled the park, claiming to have been one of those accosted by the man. Now, I don't necessarily doubt that those events happened, but I find it kind of doubtful that especially was the shoe slasher, because he seems to have usually been much more direct. He seems to have just, you know, gone after the person, attacked him, did what he needed to do, and left. And it just doesn't seem like he'd be the sort to, like, try to entice people like that. Although it does have a bit of a similarity to tactics when Ruth Zukoski was attacked, because that offender had attempted to lure her into another section of the alley before he resorted to just his usual assault. So, there's that. But then anyway, here's where things get confusing. While the police were searching for the shoe slasher in Moya Mensing, 14-year-old William Green was attacked by a tall, thin man wearing a light overcoat who slashed the instep of his foot near 19th Street and Fairmount Avenue, which is a few blocks east of Eastern State Penitentiary. To make matters even more confusing, a 14 Times article on the case indicates that Green's assault was eventually disproven. But the newspaper article cited states that it was actually another attack, which took place over in West Philadelphia, that had been disproved. But we'll get to that in a minute. Now, that same evening as William Green was attacked, another woman was supposedly pursued by a knife-wielding man near where the 30th Street subway station is presently. But there's nothing in that account, in my opinion, that definitively states that was Jack the Shoe Slasher. I mean, that was a guy with a knife chased you. There was a blizzard on the night of January 25th, and the slasher still struck. This time, the victim was a 17-year-old named James Griffin, who was attacked on North 41st Street near the Belmont Public School by a man who had been crouching behind a fence. He was cut across the instep of his foot, and he described his attacker as an Italian-looking man in a black suit and hat. Now, to return to the discussion about the 14 Times article a moment ago, this was the instance that proved to be faked, because in an act reminiscent of ones that occurred during many slasher panics worldwide, an injury had been sustained in a different way, and for whatever reason, had been laid at the feet of this offender. In this instance, unlike the Halifax slasher in Britain, this attacker actually did exist. Oh, Griffin had stumbled over a piece of glass, and that's how he cut his foot, not being attacked by Jack the Shoe Slasher. And there the story ends. Well, the Philadelphia part of the story anyway. A few days later, at about 4 o'clock on the afternoon of January 30th, a 12-year-old girl named Mary Zamborski was attacked in the Broadway Market in the Fells Point section of Baltimore. She was walking home with her sister when they noticed that they were being followed by a man in dark clothes. And when they ducked into the market house, the man followed, grabbed Mary's ankle, slashed her across the top of the foot, then said, "Excuse me, ladies," and ran off through the marketplace. As of February 4th, the girl was still bedridden from her injuries, having lost quite a bit of blood, and having been slashed with such force that one of the buttons on her shoe had been cut in half. Now, on January 31st, the next day, a Mrs. Simon Kirshner of 209 South High Street was beaten, choked, and robbed by a man who forced his way into her home. Her assailant was quickly arrested and identified as Rapold Karulis, also known as Thomas Burt. The police of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, identified him also as a known thief named Frank Barry. This seems to have been an irrelevant case, though, except for the fact that the police also felt that he answered the description furnished by Mary Zamborski of her assailant. It was planned that the police were to have Mary come to the station to see if Karulis was her attacker, but I'm not sure if that ever took place, because it was soon to prove unnecessary anyway. On the night of February 9th, a 23-year-old black woman named Louisa Davis was attacked on Woodbrook Avenue near Retreat Street, just south of the expansive Druid Hill Park in northwest Baltimore. A dark-clad man crossed the street to intercept her, and though she attempted to squirm out of the way, the man slashed downward, cutting her skirt and into the heel of her shoe. He was apparently unsuccessful in doing any actual real harm to her, however. She described a tall man with a thin face, about 24, wearing a long dark coat and a dark hat. This description tallied fairly well with almost all descriptions of the slasher that had surfaced so far from both Philadelphia and Baltimore. After about a week's time, the shoe slasher reappeared, slightly to the northeast of where Louisa was attacked. On February 15th, an 8-year-old boy named John Hibbets was attacked while he was sledding on Nicholson Street. His rubber boot had a 7-inch gash, but like many others, it appeared that the knife of the assailant hadn't actually injured his foot. The next day, another young boy named Charles Schultz, over in the Gardenville section of the city, east of there, claimed that he had been accosted by a tall man in a light overcoat and a black hat while sledding near his home on Bel Air Avenue. Charles escaped the man and he ran up the hill, and though other people had gave pursuit to the attacker, the man wasn't captured. It was almost another week before another attack took place on February 22nd. A young boy named Emmett Littleton was grabbed near his home on 2700 Bernard Avenue in the Remington District, which, like the attack on Louisa Davis, was close to the Druid Hill Park. While it was said that he was a victim of the shoe slasher, the man was quickly arrested and proved to be an unemployed man named Michael O'Shea. O'Shea seems to me, from his statements, to have been a little slow mentally, and this might be why Emmett's mother and several other neighborhood residents refused to testify against him. So, one of the main differences in the Philadelphia and Baltimore phases of this tale should be evident by now. Where the Philadelphia police made no real arrests, although there was an Italian immigrant who had become a strong suspect, Baltimore police had arrested several. In addition to the previously mentioned Rapold Carolus and Michael O'Shea, there was a drunk named Gerhard Landwehr who had been arrested on the evening of February 16th, just north of Inner Harbor. Sergeant Henry Arnold apprehended Landwehr at the urging of two young girls who ran by him. But at the station later, both Mary Zamborski and Louisa Davis both denied that Landwehr was the man who had attacked them. Another arrest was also made on the afternoon of February 22nd, when Robert Linz told an officer that Daniel Burns threatened to cut his throat on Druid Hill Avenue. Burns asked the boy where he could find a bar, and when Linz pointed one out, he entered, then he exited quickly, ran back over and pulled a knife on the boy, and, quote, threatened to cut his throat for having sent him into a bar patronized by Negroes, unquote. Unsurprisingly, Burns was not identified by any of the victims. You know, that quote brings up to me a point. It's kind of jarring, in a way, to look back through old newspaper accounts and just see this kind of, this just casual racism that just gets thrown into news stories, where they make sure to tell you what ethnic group somebody belongs to. Anyway, another arrest was also made years after the event. A railway worker by the name of Charles J. Cooper had been arrested on March 22, 1909, for having thrown acid onto the clothes of Marie Barton. However, he also had in his possession an extremely sharp knife, and it was theorized by police that arrested him that he could have been the shoe slasher of a few years before. Interestingly, Cooper had actually been arrested in 1905 for stealing women's shoes from a warehouse that he had been employed at. Now, it was always a single shoe, never the full pair. But it was also interesting that the vitriol thrower, as Cooper had been known, often threw the acid at the feet of women that he attacked. Now, by way of explanation, Cooper testified, "I am controlled by the devil when I go out to throw acid on women. I have tried to fight the impulse off, but cannot. Sometimes I would be sitting in my home, when all of a sudden a feeling would come over me, which seemed to take possession of myself. I would be impelled to go out and take with me the syringe and vitriol, and would be compelled to throw it on some woman. After it was over, I would feel different and would be sorry for what I had done. Again, I have gone out controlled by this influence which would advise me to throw acid on a woman. But my willpower at times would be so great that I could offset the desire and return home without committing the assault. It would be a self-satisfied feeling that I would get when I would throw acid on the woman, which is what caused me to do it." But the arrest of Cooper is the last we hear of the shoe slasher. Previously, on his 1905 arrest for stealing shoes, Cooper had testified,
"Often, I have stood in front of a shoe store window, held there as by chains, and fighting myself to avoid breaking the glass, gathering all the women's footwear there, and running. I have never yielded to the temptation under such condition. I have kept myself as far from this horror of life as I can. Yet it finds me out. I thought when I got this position I would be free from it. When the first pair of shoes came in my way, I fell. Try as I might, I could not help taking them. I was trying to get a position as a railroad fireman, thinking that there, at least, I would be safe." "What would you do if you were employed in a shoe factory?" the captain asked him. Cooper moved his long hand in a spasmic gesture. "I couldn't do it," he answered sharply. "So many shoes. Shoes everywhere. It would drive me mad."
Although nothing more is heard, given this compulsion and the focus on the lower body, even when he progressed to acid throwing, personally, I find it very, very likely that it was Cooper who was the slasher. Certainly, photographs of him match the general description of the slasher, as does his age, he was 27 in 1905, and most witnesses said the slasher was probably in his late 20s. I couldn't find any information as to whether Cooper had been in Philadelphia during the attacks that took place up there, though. For his crimes, Cooper received 3 months in jail. For throwing acid on 3 different women, he got 3 months in jail. And the very day of his arrest, another woman had acid thrown on her in Baltimore. So, Cooper may have been the acid thrower, but apparently he wasn't the only one. The saga of the shoe slasher might serve as a dismissal of another Fortean legend. There's occasionally been a claim that in May 1905, a laundress named Julia McGlone in Philadelphia was walking home from work near the Second National Bank building, which is right beside Independence Hall, and was accosted by a black-clad figure who threw her to the ground, spit flames, and then leapt away when a policeman appeared. Now, this is often said to be a Spring-Heeled Jack-type apparition. It had also been mentioned that there had been previous attacks by the Spring-Heeled Jack earlier that year. And a few months previous was... Right. Now, Theo Peijmans, who wrote the Fortean Times article on the shoe slasher, by the way, thanks to Sharon Hill of the 15 Credibility Street podcast, because she supplied me with a scan of the article after I somehow seemed to have misplaced the copy of it that I had. Well, anyway, I had been in contact with Theo Peijmans, and he thinks that the story of the Spring-Heeled Jack was built from the bones of the shoe slasher case, basically. I agree with him, but rather than just the slasher, I think that the story might be a conflation of both the slasher story and a sighting of the Jersey Devil in Philadelphia that took place on January 21st, 1909. That encounter was reported by a Mrs. J.H. White of Ellsworth Street, who went into her backyard to hang laundry and claimed that she was attacked by a creature who was lurking in her backyard. It was covered in a leathery reptilian skin and spit blue fire at her. She fainted, and when her husband came into the yard in response to her screams, the creature fled over a fence. Now, I think the general outline of the events in that encounter line up really well with what's supposed to happen in the McGlone encounter. You have, she's hanging laundry, so you have kind of a laundress connection. You have this humanoid figure, this tall humanoid figure that spits fire, the woman falls on the ground, another person comes in, and the thing disappears when the other person appears. So, the general outline is the same. And then the foot or heel connection was probably provided by someone who misremembered the slasher panic. And then the story of the Spring-Heeled Jack was born. And that's the end of this episode. A list of sources consulted for this episode can be found in the show description. If you have a question, a comment, or if you know a lesser-known story that you'd like to see covered on the show, leave a comment on the podcast page, post it to our Facebook page at Forgotten Darkness Podcast, or send it to our email at ForgottenDarkness77, lowercase f, lowercase d, all one word, at gmail.com. And so until next episode, this is Andrew signing off.